Wrinkle, Francis Kelman, 8 counts of rape murder, 5 counts of wounding, 3 counts of public affray.
Him? That kid?
It's what it says. The system is never wrong,
the clerk said.
He's just a kid.
The clerk shrugged.
How old does the system say this Wrinkle is meant to be?
Asked the guard. The clerk consulted his display.
68.
68?
He's had work done.
My arse he has. Juvenile drugs?
Suggested one of the other guards.
He's just a kid, the lead guard repeated.
There was a long pause. The clerk shrugged again.
You're right. It's a mistake.
The lead guard nodded.
Thank you.
Let's scan him again and sort this out,
the clerk added.
Right, the guard said.
He turned to Kiss and the boy.
Come on, son. We have to read your end again to sort this out.
No, I won't. I saw what happened last time.
Zale's voice came out from behind Kiss's legs.
Be a good boy now, Kiss said. This nice man is trying to help you.
Zale had already peeled the molded plastic glove off his hand, removing the fake handprint. He had tucked the peel into Kiss's trouser pocket.
Come on, kid, up you come. We can sort this out nice and simple, said the guard, holding out an armored hand.
Vents are cooking off nicely now, Kara voxed. Overheat in 2 minutes.
Excellent, Carl responded. Zale placed his hand on the reader plate. There was a pause as the system considered the findings.
Hoffman, Arab Bej, said the clerk. 14 years old. Registered to the Skolam Informal H.
The alarms suddenly cut off. The silence was shocking.
System re-enabled,
the clerk said. There was a series of whines as the security gates and cages began to retract into their wall slots.
I told you it was a mistake, the guard said.
Carl Thonius heard the alarms shut down.
Well, he whispered, I do love it when a plan comes together.
He had run down a wide flight of steps into the deserted inner rotunda, and along a hallway to the arched doorway of one of the Informium's 7,000 clericulums. It was empty. The clerks had evacuated at the sound of the alarm. The rows of abandoned cogitator desks winked and flashed. The optic scanners at the doorway simply accepted his permit as he went inside. He sat down at the first desk. The system was still running, open. In their hurry to evacuate, as Carl had predicted, none of the clerks had shut down their cogitators. No user codes to break, no pass keys. Carl punched up some data gates, and the screen showed entry to the main banks. Then he opened his document case and took out the compact codifier concealed inside. Carl connected it to the desk's outports, and the little machine began to murmur and sigh. Carl cracked his knuckles and prepared to type.
Any minute now,
he said. Simultaneously, red warning lights lit up on every desk. A box appeared on the valve screens announcing a system overheat. The sabotage Kara and Nail had performed on the rooftop radiator vanes was finally registering. The Informium's vast data system was programmed to hibernate if an overheat was experienced. It was automatic. The databases shut themselves down, and subsystems also disengaged to try and compensate for the problem. The first routines to close off were the activity records, which meant that any operation conducted during hibernation would not be logged. When the system came back up, there would be no trace at all of any tampering or adjustment. Carl delicately loaded the graft program from his codifier. It sank into the Informium's oceanic mass of data and vanished, literally without trace. But it would stay there, and through it, Carl would be able to access any material he needed.
We're done, he voxed. Extract yourselves. Thank you. Sorry for your trouble,
Kiss told the guards as she led Zale away across the entry and out into the night. They nodded goodbye. The rain had eased a little. Zale was stripping off the second plastic palm, the one he'd worn under the first. A transport pulled out of a side street opposite and drew up at the curb. The cabin door popped open. At the wheel, Zeph Mathewin nodded to them.
Good job, kid, he said. Get in.
Kara and Nail slithered down the metal roof. They had removed the insulation felts so the vanes could resume their normal function.
Want to try batting out?
Nail voxed. Not in this wind. We'll go over the wall on the fasteners. Nail pulled out the climb anchors and fixed them to the inside lip of the roof balustrade. He handed a line to Kara.
One sec, she said.
Carl, we're about to drop the east facade on fast gear. What's the situation? Everyone out?
Just me inside still, and I'll be out in a sec. Off you go.
Understood. Kara turned to Nail. Let's drop, she said. They took their lines in their hands, double-tugged to make sure the anchors were locked, and walked backwards over the lip of the wall. Then they kicked free. As they fell down the wet stone face of the Informium, the miniature winding gears took up and carefully moderated their plunge. The alarm was over. The guards in the north portico of the Informium were thanking the visitors for their compliance and sending them on their way.
Everyone's accounted for, one of the guards called to the chief clerk.
All the visitors?
All of them. Everyone.
Good job, the clerk replied. I'm scanning only one anomaly. Docent Wigger did not check in or out during the lockdown.
Where's Wigger?
The guard yelled out, his voice echoing across the marble space.
Here, sir, right here, the docent cried, running forward. System says you didn't check in or out, the guard said.
But I did, sir, the docent replied. As soon as the alarms went off, I went through the barrier to my assembly point.
With that,
the guard said, pointing. The docent looked down. The ribbon pinned to his robe front was pale yellow.
Oh, crap, the docent said.
Lockdown! Lockdown! The guard yelled out, turning. We have an intruder!
The alarms began to bay again. The cages came down. The Informian depository, for the second time in the same night, locked up tight. Chapter 5 Carl Thonius heard the alarms shrilling. He sat up straight.
Oh, no,
he whispered to himself.
No, 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 no.
He began to unclip the codifier from the desk ports and put it away. Carl.
Everything's fine. It's fine.
It's not. This isn't part of the plan.
These things happen. I can deal with it.
The building's on lockdown. You need help.
No, he snapped. Honestly, sir, I'm on this. I can handle it.
Carl closed the document case and realized his right hand was shaking. The tremors were intense, and he could only stifle them by grabbing his right hand with his left.
Carl, I can do this!
Carl got up. Then he punched himself in the mouth. It was easier than he'd imagined. His right arm hadn't seemed like part of him since Flint. It was like someone else hitting him. It wasn't shaking any more. He took off his permit and tossed it into the wastebasket. Then he went out into the corridor, purposefully dribbling the blood from his split lips down his front. Three guards ran up.
That way! He went that way! He hit me!
Carl cried.
Get into cover, sir!
The guard leader yelled, and they ran on. I had a good remote view of Carl Thonius now. He was heading back towards the north entry. I could feel how much he wanted to do this, how much he wanted to prove himself. But his plan had just gone up in smoke. I didn't blame him. The unexpected came with the job. Carl, stop it. Your plan's broken. You need my help.
I can do this, he repeated.
No, you can't. You've done a great job tonight, but I'm taking charge now. Do exactly what I tell you. The original version of the plan would have seen Carl sneak out the way he'd got in, but the cover had been blown on his stolen permit. Now we had to go with my version, the worst-case version. All right, not the worst-case version. That involved Zeff and his rotator cannon. All the same, Carl was very unhappy, as I told him what I wanted him to do.
I don't like this, he whispered.
Neither do I. It'll be a strain. Keep walking.
The atrium was seething with security officers. The moment Carl passed the optic scanners at the gate, he'd be detected. Wait. A few guards passed through the barrier and began to spread out into the building, joining the search. We let a couple go by, Carl huddled back in a doorway, until one came along that was roughly his build and height. This one. Carl came out of cover behind the man and felled him with a neat folded talon punch to the back of the neck.
I could have done that.
Well, it wasn't beyond me.
But you bruise like a ploin.
Carl laughed mirthlessly and dragged the guard into a side office.
Do I have to wear his awful clothes?
No, there's no time. Just let me see his face.
Carl rolled the man so he was staring up at him. and I wore Carl's eyes for a moment to get a clear view. All right. Are you ready?
Just do it.
I reached out with my mind and gently began to knead the muscles of Carl's face. He whimpered in discomfort. I slackened some, tightened others, caused flesh to swell and droop, pinched eyelids. His face was like clay. It hurt him a lot.
Are you done?
He slurred, his lips ill-fitting. Just about. It'll do. You've got about 5 minutes before it starts to relax.
Throne, it hurts.
Move, Carl. He started back towards the gates, limping, coming into plain view and pushing past the banks of optical scanners. Several guards turned and trained their weapons on him.
Hold it, you. Jackson.
Bastard got me, Carl slurred. Bastard got me and took my kit.
The guards started to scramble towards the gate.
Be advised, one yelled into his link. Intruder may be disguised as staff security and using Jackson's permit.
Two of the men vaulted the gate in their hurry. Carl limped on past them, ignored. Almost.
So why are you wearing his clothes?
Another guard asked.
Bastard left me bare-ass naked,
Carl growled, fighting to stop his unnaturally slackened lips from drooling.
You okay?
Just need some air. Hit my head hard.
Carl limped on. The exit arch of the portico seemed so far away. Keep going. Another 50 meters. Another 40. Moving as fast as he dared without drawing attention to himself. 10 meters.
Hey! Hey!
Carl stopped and turned slowly.
What?
You want me to get a Medicaid to check you out, Jackson?
No, thanks. Just let me catch my breath. I'll be fine.
Another few steps. The smell of the rain. The night air. Carl was out. A few at a time, they came back to me in the ruined stack hideaway. Patience and Zale first, followed by Zeph, who'd taken a few extra minutes to conceal his transport in a lock-up storage hut.
You did well.
Patience nodded and went into the mouldering bedroom to strip off her ragged clothes and put on something a little more Patience kiss.
You too, Zale,
I said, switching to transponder. The boy wasn't listening. He was trying to peer around the door into the room where Patience was changing. Winston Frauke put down his slate, leaned forward, and gently turned the boy's head to face me.
Adults only, kiddo, he said.
Zale scowled, partly because his view had been deprived, mostly because Frauke had leaned back on the sofa and, under the show of reading his slate, taken a good connoisseur's eyeful himself. A kine blade whacked into the seat back beside Frauke's neck and quivered.
Hey, just checking you're okay, Patty, Frauke said.
A second kine blade thumped in beside the first.
Not a Patty, right,
said Frauke, unruffled, and turned back to his reed and his latest smoke. The kine blades pulled themselves out and hovered back into the bedroom.
You did well, Zale, I repeated.
Did I?
How did you feel it went?
Okay,
he shrugged.
You played your part.
Yeah, like Mr. Thurnius said. With the faked-up handprints. Is this what it's like?
What?
Being part of an Inquisitor's warband.
Sometimes.
There wasn't much war.
Then thank the Emperor for that, I told him. Go get yourself some refreshment.
Zale wandered away and found the bags of salt rind and the swota loaves we'd bought the night before. Zeph came in, damp with rain.
Any problems? I asked him.
He shook his head.
Were you followed?
He looked at me as if to question the temerity of such a suggestion. Watch the stairwell, please. Zeph took out his handgun, armed it, and went back out into the dim hallway. 28 minutes later, Nail and Kara arrived. They came in and began to strip off their packs.
Well done, I said.
Is Carl out? Asked Kara.
He's on his way.
I heard there was a problem, Nail said.
Everything's fine. Carl got what we wanted. Frauke tossed him a lit low stick, and Nail caught it in his teeth.
Sweet,
Nail said. Carl Thonius arrived last. I heard some banter on the stairs, Zeph pretending he didn't recognize Carl and threatening to wail on him. There was a heated exchange.
"That awful man's a complete frigwit," Carl said when he came in.
Truth was, he didn't look like Carl Thonius, nor did he look like the guard whose visage I had moulded. The slackening had begun, the stroke-like collapse of muscle tension as the effect faded. Carl looked dreadful, and though the process was passing, it was painful as it wore off.
"Holy throne," said Patience. "Just don't look at me,"
Carl said, and wandered into the bedroom. "You did well, Carl. Really well."
"Whatever."
Alone in the bedroom, Carl sat down on a creaking chair in front of the dressing mirror and gazed at his face. Tears welled in his eyes as he tugged at the misshapen muscles and tissue with his fingertips. He knew the suffering would end soon, and he'd get his face back. He tried to take his hands away, but the right hand stayed there, pinching and pulling at the flesh of his face. He had to grip his right wrist with his left hand to drag it away. He wanted to feel better. He'd fouled up. He'd been given a chance, and he'd spoiled it. He wanted to feel better. There was a way. The way was in his coat pocket. He knew he couldn't do that here, not in such an intimate billet. But the craving.
"Carl," Patience peered in around the door. "You okay?" "I'll be fine. Facial transfiguration by psionic manipulation is a complex process. Painful and may take many hours to relax. 4 to 5 hours is the norm, after the initial slackening, though some tics and discomforts may be felt as long as 48 hours later."
"And the stuff you know," she smiled. Carl stared at himself in the dirty mirror.
"I don't know who I am any more, Kiss," he said.
"Oh, that's just the face thing," she said, and pushed the door shut after her.
"Not what I meant," he said at his reflection. "Not what I meant at all."
Chapter 6 It was a chilly morning, but at least they had been spared rain. The sky over Formal A in the heart of Petropolis lowered like grey smoke. When Deputy Magistratum Dursk Rickens got out of his matte-black transporter in the wide flagstone plaza of Templum Square, the first thing he noticed was the knot of onlookers gathered around the main doors of the Grand Templum, and the two uniformed officers keeping them out. Rickens approached. He walked with a steel-shod cane, the legacy of an old line-of-duty injury. He observed the crowd, mostly worshippers, the sick or the elderly, their sores plastered with faith paper, waiting to get into the Grand Templum to receive their daily blessings and the food provided by the almoners. But there were temple clerics, too, young men in robes of scarlet and purple. They looked upset. Why weren't they being let inside? The Grand Templum was an ancient, towering place, though it was dwarfed by the enormous administrative towers around it. It was just one of the tens of thousands of ecclesiarchy temples and chapels in the wide city, but it was held in particular regard because of its location. It stood at what was popularly regarded as the precise geographical center point of Petropolis, which made it the axis of all city life and faith. It was here that the primary religious services were held, here that the chief ministers and men of office observed the feast days and holy days, here that the nobility and the highborn were baptized, married, and seen to their rest. It was here that the Lord Governor's subsector were inaugurated. With a nod to the uniforms, Rickens went through the crowd and into the Templum. He loved it in here. The delicious cool, the tobacco darkness, the coloured windows, the sense of boundless space. The domed vault was so high that the images of the God Emperor and his primarchs painted up there were only half visible in the candlelight. Rickens advanced down the nave, his cane tapping against the marble tiles. He was just a tiny speck in that immensity. When his wife had passed away, he'd come here a lot, to sit and mourn in the tranquillity. Junior Marshal Plighton suddenly appeared at a door in the West End and hurried down to him the moment she saw him.
"Morning, sir. Sorry to call you in.
Something you can't handle?"
"Something I think you should, sir."
Maud Plighton was a dark-haired woman in her early 20s, her slightly thick-set frame curiously at odds with her delicate features. The functional duty uniform and harness she wore were not flattering to her build. Rickens thought highly of her. She was a sharp-witted and extremely capable officer. It worried him that she thought this was something she couldn't deal with herself. "Particulars?" he asked, as they started to walk towards the West End. "A senior cleric of the Templum, Archdeacon Ulsman, has died."
"In here?"
"No, sir. In the old sacristy, actually. But I thought we should close the entire place until we've checked over everything."
"And what's the answer to the question?"
Rickens said. Plighton smiled. Rickens was the head of the Department of Special Crimes, the smallest and most underfunded of the Hive's magistratum divisions. Their remit was essentially to investigate anything that did not fit into the procedural scope of the other departments. They got the odd, the weird, the nonsensical, and, most often, the downright boring wastes of time nobody else wanted to be bothered with. The question was what Rickens always asked his officers. Why us? Why has this been given to special crimes?
"Because we don't know what sort of crime it is, or even if it is a crime," Plighton said.
"The beat marshals who were first on the scene called it in to us because they didn't know who else to vox."
"I see."
"There's also the sensitivity issue, sir," said Plighton. "That's why I sent for you. The suspicious death of a senior cleric in what is, let's face it, the most revered sacred building in the Hive. I thought we should be seen to be dealing with it seriously."
Smart woman, Rickens thought. They passed through the west entrance and out along a wide exterior cloister to the door of the old sacristy. Though now regarded as a side chapel and annex of the Grand Templum, the sacristy was actually an entirely separate building. It predated the Templum itself by nearly 3 centuries, and had actually been the city's original high church in the early years. As Petropolis expanded and grew, the sacristy was deemed too slight and too small to properly serve a thriving hive state, and the Grand Templum had been raised beside it, and turning it into just one of the many buildings, dormitories, almshouses, beneficent chapels, and church schools that clustered around the Grand Templum's skirts. They entered the sacristy. Though far smaller than the Grand Templum, it was still an impressive vault. The narrow dome was painted with gilt figures against a white field, and this, together with the deep, clear glass windows, made the place seem much lighter and brighter than the Great Temple. But it also showed its great age and the way it had been neglected in favour of its more splendid neighbour. Plaster peeled, and there were patches of damp on the limed walls. The stone flooring was worn, and the slabs cracked and uneven. Rickens saw the scaffolding at once. It was hard to miss it, especially because of the man hanging by the neck from the upper platform.
"That's the Reverend Cleric?" asked Rickens. "Or is there something you're not telling me?"
"That's him," Plighton said. "We left him in situ while we covered the scene. Medicae mortis and forensic physic are waiting to move in."
"He hanged himself," Rickens said.
"He hanged to death, yes," replied Plighton. "More than that, we don't know. Suicide? Murder? Accident?" She shrugged.
The scaffolding was a huge structure that reached right up into the bowl of the dome. Pews had been cleared aside to accommodate it. Drip sheets had been stretched out, and there were piles of unassembled scaffolding, along with artists' equipment and pails of paint and lime. 2 more of Rickon's junior marshals were present, Brewers and Rodinsky. Brewers was standing beside a long-haired young man in paint-spattered overalls who was sitting on a pew.
"What do we know?"
Rickens asked.
"The sacristy is undergoing cleaning and restoration, sir," said Plighton. "Archdeacon Ulsman was responsible for supervising and approving the work."
"Who's the young man?"
"A limner. Name's Yearnwood. Part of the restoration team working on the dome. He's eager. Very skilled, I think. Loves his work. He came in early this morning to put in a few extra hours. It seems he found something up there, sir. When Ulsman looked in to see how he was getting on, Yearnwood took him up the scaffolding and showed him what he'd found. And then..."
"Then?"
"Yearnwood's not making much sense. Ulsman was troubled, apparently. Upset. Before Yearnwood understood what was happening, the Archdeacon had fallen off the scaffolding. Either he got tangled in a trailing rope on the way down, or it was already around his neck. Anyway, here we are."
"And you make of it what?"
Rickens asked her.
"Like I said, a nasty accident. An unconventional suicide. Or someone, and the fingers would point at Yearnwood, killed him."
Rickens looked around the sacristy again. There was something about the place that had always made him feel uncomfortable. In the days immediately after his wife's passing, he'd come here first, assuming the sacristy would be more private and soothing than the Grand Templum. But for all its lime-wash white and glowing gilt, it had seemed oppressive, enclosing. After a few visits, he'd taken to sitting in the umbran shadows of the Grand Templum instead.
"If Ulsman killed himself, we'll soon know," Rickens said.
"I've already got Limwall running background checks," Plighton said, "trying to turn up any private troubles."
"Tell him to be thorough. Secret deaths, hidden illness, the usual things, up to and including shameful secrets involving altar boys or dining hall waitresses."
"Of course."
"Thorough but circumspect, Plighton. I want to find secrets, not create a juicy scandal."
"Sir?" Rickens tapped his way over to Brewer's and the young man. The young man was very handsome, in a wild, artistic way. Long, agile fingers, long hair romantically flecked with dots of paint. A long face, narrow and bony, with the sort of stark cheekbones Rickens had last seen on himself in his graduation pict. Magistratum induction, class of 72. 272. "I'm getting old," Rickens thought.
"Rickens, special crime. What can you tell me, Master Yearnwood?"
The young limner looked up. His eyes were wet with tears, and he was shaking.
"He just fell off."
"Why did he fall?"
"He was upset. I'd showed him what I'd found. It surprised me too, of course. But when he saw it, he just went to pieces. He was shouting these things I didn't understand, and..."
"What had you found, Master Yearnwood?"
"The other ceiling, sir."
Rickens looked up at the dome, and then back down at the restorer.
"Other ceiling?"
Yearnwood swallowed.
"I've been working on the dome for weeks now, replacing the gilt where the damp had got to it. It's bad in places. You have to lie on your back on the scaffold and work above you. It's tiring on the arms."
"I bet."
"Some parts have just collapsed. I mean, the lime plaster's like wet paper and just hanging off. There was a particularly bad bit up there."
The limner rose and pointed to a shadowy black stain on the roof just above the golden shoulder of St. Kyodrus.
"It was really going with the recent rain, so I came in early to try and seal it before it spread. I got up there, and it just came away."
Rickon saw a splattered mess of old plaster and shredded mulch on the sacristy floor under the scaffolding.
"I thought for a second the whole dome was going to fall on me,"
Yearnwood went on.
"Then I saw the hole. It's quite big. A hole right through the dome. So I got a lamp and looked up through it."
"What did you see, Master Yearnwood?"
"The other roof. Like I said, this dome is a false ceiling. There's a cavity up there, and beyond it, there's a whole other dome about 2 meters above it. It's painted. I mean, the frescoes are beautiful. So very old. There's no record of it. I mean, it must have been hidden up there for centuries. Centuries. Why would they cover something like that over? Why doesn't anyone know about it?"
"This is what you showed the Archdeacon."
Yearnwood nodded glumly.
"He was intrigued. Excited when I told him. He climbed up, borrowed my light, looked through. Then he simply went mad."
"Describe mad."
"He came back out of the hole, and first off he was just murmuring and shaking. Then he started shouting and threw the lamp at me. I ducked. I didn't want to fall. Next thing I knew, he was dead."
Yearnwood nodded. Rickens looked around at his juniors.
"Anyone else taken a look?"
Brewers and Radinsky shrugged.
"Not yet, sir,"
Plighton admitted.
"Maud," Rickens said, "there's no way in the world I'm going to get up there, with my hip."
Plighton nodded. Rickens only called her Maud when he really needed her. She stripped off her gloves, unhooked her helmet from her belt, tossed the gloves inside it, and handed it to Brewers. Then she slid out her power maul and gave that to him too.
"Be careful,"
Rickens said.
"I've a head for heights,"
she grinned.
"That's not actually what I mean,"
Rickens muttered. Plighton started up the scaffold ladder. The entire structure trembled slightly as she went. The lashed ladders zigzagged up the scaffolding frame. The air had become very cold by the time she reached the top platform. The last part of the climb had taken her right up past Olsman's body. So close she had looked into his bloodshot eyes and seen the swollen, mauve flesh of his throttled face. His body had begun to pendulum slightly from the vibrations of her ascent. Maud Plighton had no head for heights at all, but she was damned if she'd let her beloved superior down. The floor of the chapel was so far away now, the figures looking up at her were the size of dolls. "Crap," she whispered, as she finally dared to rise to her feet on the top platform. So high up. The platform boards did not quite meet, and she could see the drop between them. That was so much worse. That and the vibration. "Look up," she told herself. The dome was just above her face. What had looked splendid and golden from the ground was mouldering and rotten close up. She could smell the decay, see the gilt tissue peeling like scabs from the blind faces of disintegrating worthies. St. Kiodris's face had discoloured so much that it looked as dark and dead as the archdeacon's. Left hand out for balance, Plighton walked along the boards, plucking her service stab light from her belt and switching it on. The tight, bright lance shone like a lasbeam in the cool gloom. She saw the hole, the mucky, blackened puncture in the ceiling. The smell of rot was more intense here. Old air, stagnant like water that had stood too long. The smell wafted out of the hole. She looked up through the hole, aiming her light.
"Oh, holy throne," she said.
"Plighton," her vox link buzzed.
"Plighton, what can you see?"
"Another ceiling, sir," she said. "Like the man said, a whole other dome above this one. It extends. Throne, I can't see how far. So old. So very old."
Golden images, figures, faces, intagliated beams, lapis lazuli and pure Celpic, ornate lettering in traced silver, lines and constellations, a hint of some vast organized chart that covered the ceiling.
"Plighton! Maud!"
"Sir, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen."
Chapter 7. 2 days after Carl's successful penetration of the Informium depository, my team took up occupation of a rented townhouse in the 9th ward of Formal E. The house was called Miseramus, and it was a dank, sulking manse of rain-eaten ooze-light and formstone that stood in a quiet upstack neighbourhood of private gardens and secluded mansions. The lease was acquired in the name of Morton Narvan. The forename was that of a childhood friend of Nails, the family name that of the first boy Kara had kissed. Carl Thonius's devious concealed graft program had done the rest, including transferring down payment from an obscured account to the rental guild. Hidden within the Informium's data core, the graft program could now provide anything we needed, not falsified, but genuinely created by the unimpeachable archive of all records. It was superb work, but I think none of us showed proper appreciation to Carl. It was the sort of thing we expected from him. He remained sullen and unhappy about the way things had gone. The empty halls and chambers of the unfurnished townhouse were cold and unfamiliar, but it was a home of sorts, a safe house. We settled in. Carl and Patience went out and purchased some simple items of furniture to make it livable. They used false names and false accounts provided by the graft. In those first few days, that became the game. My friends would sit around and dream up alter egos, and Carl would tap his codifier, send them through the Informium's data wash, and make them real. It cheered him up somewhat to amuse the others with his skill. There was a tension, however, an apprehension about the task ahead. We had names, most of which Sko had provided. Akunin, Vigold, Maribos, Foucault, Strikeson, Braden. Each one the shipmaster of a rogue trader, each one a member of the Contract 13 cartel. "Search them down," I told Carl. "Find out if any are logged as on planet. Find me the backgrounds and trade histories. Find me connections. What links them?" Carl nodded. "You have the Informium at your disposal now, Carl. The central registry of data is in this subsector.
and you can use it to sift and search it invisibly. Do so.
Carl had set up in the east bedroom, his equipment resting on packing cases. His cogitators had a vapor link to the local wireless mast, registered via the graft to an invented rickshaw firm, and dry-stroke ground splices to the main civic data conduits in the street outside, courtesy of a midnight pavement excavation by Nail and Zeph. He also had click links to the municipal Vox system and landlines.
"What else am I looking for?"
he asked. "Links to the Ministry of Subsector Trade," I replied. "Anything fuzzy, anything irregular. Yader Trice especially. We can't be sure, but there's a better-than-good chance he knew he was sending us downriver into a death-trap when he teamed us with his agents last year. Who knows, Trice may be clean and the conspiracy might be operating at a level below him, but I met him, and I doubt it. By the same token, look upwards."
"At the Lord Governor?"
"At the Lord Governor. If Barazan himself is involved, I need to know as soon as possible. It makes our action here so much harder if this rot has spread to the very top."
"I'll get to work," Carl said.
"One last thing," I said. "See what you can recover concerning the divine frattery." Carl nodded again. I told him everything about the warning my once mentor Eisenhorn had delivered on Malinta 6 months earlier. Thorn had been quite specific. The Divine Frattery, a cult of seers based on Nova Durma, who delighted in far-seeing the future and then manipulating it to their own dark ends, had seen something, a prospect, that concerned either me or one of my team. We would awaken something here on Eustace Majoris before the end of the year, which was just a few short months away now, and the Imperium would pay dearly for that mistake. The danger went by the name of Slight, or Slight, or Sleet, or something of that form. I hated farseers. I'd done enough farseeing myself in my early days with the Eldar to know that way led only to madness. I was also concerned about the Cognite connection. The Cognite was, is, a cult school for genius heretical minds run nearly a century before by a witch named Lillian Chase. My nemesis, the now-dead Zygmunt Moloch, had been a pupil of that school. Though shut down, its hand was in everything, stirring, tainting, fiddling. So many of its brethren were out there, unrecognized. I had encountered a shipmaster on my way into Lucky Space, a man named Siskind. He had been one of the Cognite bloodline, and his cousin, Kisere Thekla, master of the October Country, had been the primary architect of our fate at Bonner's Reach. Although deceased, one member of the Contract 13 cartel had enjoyed strong Cognite associations. It made me worry. Were we entering a war as bloody and deceitful as the campaign we had waged against the bastard Moloch? I left Carl to his work, and glided along the empty halls of the townhouse. In one room, I saw Kara working out against a makeshift punch bag. Her compact, voluptuous body was clad only in tight shorts and a vest, and it moved wonderfully as she slammed blow after blow at the target. I so resented my enclosed state. Nearby, Whiston Frauke was asleep on a window seat. I pinched my mind and extinguished his still-burning low-stick as I slid past. In the next room, Kiss and Zeph sat either side of an upturned box and played regicide. Kiss was laughing coyly. I sensed how much she was attracted to Mathuin, and how little of that infatuation he realized. In the next room down the hall, Harlan Nail, stripped to the waist, was standing before a trestle table on which the tools of his trade were laid out. Autoguns, las pistols, bolters, sense rifles, grenades, daggers and estocks, throwing darts, revolvers, pump guns, sting blunts, synapse disruptors, ammo drums, mags, individual loads, a matched pair of fighting poniards, a long las, an Urudeshi-made assault weapon. I watched him as he selected each weapon in turn, spun it, slammed home a clip, aimed, dry-fired, then unloaded swiftly and cleaned. It was like watching a conjurer at work, a card sharp. So smooth, so deft, so certain. He reached down and grabbed a twin set of 9mm Hostech 5 autos, burnished in gold, raised them, one in each hand, spun them forward, spun them back, click, clack, click, smacked them into grip, forward spun them again, and then set them down. I wasn't the only one watching. In the corner of the room, I spied Zale. He was staring in awe at Nail's activities.
"What do they do?"
he asked.
"The Fives. They kill folk."
"How?"
"Your basic squeeze and forget. Self-aiming. One touch drains the clip. Here's the slide, see?"
"Where?"
Nail beckoned him over and racked back the top of one of the golden pistols.
"See? The ejector port here. The safety. Here's where the mag loads in."
I left them to their study. One final room to visit, and I did so only with my mind. The guest bedroom. Locked, the room was bare except for a wooden chair in the middle of the room. Sko sat in the chair, his wrists manacled, and the manacles secured by a long chain to an iron peg Mathwin had secured through a floor joist. The chain gave him enough slack to walk around the chair or lie down beside it on a blanket. The window, the door, and the walls were out of reach. We checked on him regularly. He never seemed to do anything except sleep or sit silently on the chair, staring at the wall. It was tempting to think he was broken and harmless, but Sko was a huntsman, one of the very best, and that meant he excelled at stillness and patience. I knew he was only waiting for us to make a mistake. My link bipped. It was Carl.
"Chaikov," he said. "Keeps coming up. If not banker to the cartel, then money launderer at the very least."
We thought as much. "Can we get anything on her?"
"No, it's a dead connect. I can't hack her systems. We'll have to face to face with her."
"Understood.
She fronts a fabric import place in Formal K."
"Then that's where we'll go. But we have to be careful."
"Careful? I couldn't agree more."
Carl and I had not been idle during our months spent in transit aboard Unworth's vessel. We had been preparing the ground, investigating, searching data, developing evidence. All Inquisitors do this. If they tell you they don't, they're either lying or incompetent. I know for a fact my old mentor Eisenhorn would spend months, years sometimes, locking together the intricate webs of data that supported his investigations. Any effort of the Inquisition founders immediately if the ground is not well prepared. I had a backfile of data on Contract 13 that filled 26 slates. Carl and I charted the threads together on a tri-D strategium, the five-flank rigged up in the belly-hold of the Arethusa. Such an obedient, capable creature, that man-hound. I am sure Unworth underestimates him. 2 light days out from Eustace Majoris, Carl and I finally settled on our preferred strategy. The names, the places, the links. Where we would look first. As an analogy, imagine a Verthin nest. You know the thing. That great hummock of chewed material, populated by a billion stinging insects. Stick a probe in, dig it in, and you'll be stung badly by a swarm of soldier Verthin, most of which you have no business with. Petropolis is like that. You need to be delicate, careful, extend your probes without hostility into the bowels to get results. There has to be a careful process of inquiry and inspection, divulging secrets without the keepers of those secrets knowing you've exposed them. Delicacy is the key. That's why we had the strategy. None of us wanted to get stung. We would put it together carefully, piece by piece. Now Chaikov seemed to be the first. The hard-nosed round struck a steel cabinet, glanced off, and started to tumble. It passed through a stack of files on the nearby desk and hit Harlan Nail in the upper left arm, deformed and flat on. There was a puff of blood and a spatter of meat, and Nail started to fall, growling in pain. So much for bloody careful.
"You snutwipe,"
spat Patience Kiss, and pinned the Moody Hammer's neck to the doorpost with 2 kind blades. Dying, twitching, he dropped the auto pistol, blue smoke still spilling from its muzzle. Nail came up behind the desk, his left arm streaming with blood, and fired his transvasor heavy twice. A second hammer folded and fell hard as he came in through the door.
"We've started something,"
Nail grimaced.
"No, do you think?"
Kiss replied. Lazraun started to whip down the hallway outside. They broke in blossoms of orange flame as they impacted.
"Where's Chaikov?" "No, honestly, I'm fine, thanks.
Nail growled, returning fire on auto. His weapon made a dull, dead sound in the enclosed chamber.
"I've got her," Kara reported.
She was in the corridor outside, overlooking the vast loading bay of the fabric importer warehouse, high in stack 567 of formal K. There was the tiny, round-shouldered figure of Chaikov, scurrying away under escort to a waiting flyer. Already the massive exit hatch of the bay was winching open on thick, catenary chains. Kara leapt off the balcony into the bay, somersaulting, an Urdeshi machine pistol in each hand. She was firing before she even landed, her caseless rounds stripped through the hammers around Chaikov, bursting blood steam into the cold air of the dock, dropping them like stones. Chaikov turned. She was tall, her black hair pinned in a bun, her face sheathed behind a Molidiscu mask of silver velvet. She wore a long gown of embroidered ordskin that swirled around her like gleaming smoke as she faced Kara. Gold and red and pamaganta. Her long legs were bound in white linen, her feet arched high on brass clogs.
"Face to face," Kara said,
tossing the empty machine pistols away to either side so they slithered across the deck.
"And research says..."
"Karl is sure her favorite weapon is the Lytoji whip."
"Let's hope Karl's right,"
Kara replied, drawing the shivered sword sheathed over her back. The sword had been mine when I'd been a wielder of such hand weapons long ago. Forged so hard by the hammers of master smiths, the blade had been knocked slightly sideways in time, so it resonated and shivered against the mundane now. A beautiful weapon, and Kara Swole was beautiful enough to wield it. Chaikov produced her weapon, a Lytoji whip, just as Karl had predicted. 8 meters of thin, boiling, sentient iron, manufactured by an abominable race who dwelt deep in the outworlds. The winding length of the whip curled in the air and flew at Kara, hungry. She swept up with the sword and took a meter off the whip. The cut length fell to the deck, its fused end fizzling. Chaikov cried out and lashed again. Another 2 meters of living metal flew away, smoldering at the cut. Chaikov ripped out yet again with her truncated weapon, and this time the shorn tip glanced away from Kara's block.
"Got anything else, bitch?"
Kara said, her hand braced on the raised, shivered sword. Chaikov dropped the Lytoji whip. It fell dead on the deck. She turned and reached a hand out towards the open hatchway of her flyer. A sword flew into her grasp. It was a power weapon, the blade wide and long, the grip double-handed, keyed to her response. Even from a distance, I could smell and taste its thirst. Blood. It was vampire steel, hungry and insolent.
"I have this, bitch,"
Chaikov replied, and executed a flourish with the blade. Holding her shivered sword up in her right hand, Kara beckoned with the fingers of her left.
"Then let's go," she said.
"Well, this is unexpectedly annoying,"
Karl Thonius said. "What is?" I asked.
"This,"
he said, indicating the engraved glass cube sitting on the top of an otherwise plain burwood desk in Chaikov's private quarters. "Oh, good," I replied. "For a moment I thought you were still banging on about the slight tear in your fernsy mantle." He looked wounded and glanced sadly at the pulled threads on the hem of his expensive, fur-lined cape. He'd caught it on a doorpost coming in.
"Well, that is a dreadful crime. I love this mantle so. But I had put it out of my mind and moved on to other things. How shallow do you think I am?"
"One may to answer that," I replied. "We're raiding a premises, and you come dressed up for a gaudy night." Karl adored fine clothes and prided himself on his turnout. For this endeavor, where the rest of the team were wearing body gloves and wire armor, he'd chosen the mantle, a silk blouse embroidered with silver thread, purskin pantaloons, and little slippers of gold crepe.
"You can talk," he said. "You got dressed up too."
It was true. I had. I was wearing Zeph Mathewin. My physical form was a considerable distance away, in Miseramus' house, watched over by Whiston and Zale. My mind had possessed Mathewin's body for the duration of the mission. Wearing is a skillful, strange activity. I am able to wear almost anyone, though the level of trauma for both me and the subject increases dramatically if they are unwilling. I hardly ever used Nail, Kiss, or Karl this way, except in emergencies. It was too much like hard work. Kara was more pliant, though wearing her left her weary and strung out. For some reason, Zeph was the most usable candidate in my team. I could slip in and out of his mind with a minimum of pain. He never objected. It was one of the reasons he remained in my employ. Wearing gave me a physical presence I otherwise lacked, and the opportunity to empty the skills and talents of the subject directly. Zeph Methuen was a tall and powerful man, an ex-bounty hunter like Nail. His skin was dark, and his black hair tightly braided out down his back. His eyes were little, unreadable coals of red hard light. His left hand was a polished chrome augmetic tool. He was a mystery, his past a secret, a blank. Even from inside his mind, I knew little about him, except that which he was prepared to tell me. I never probed. Methuen worked for me because he liked the work, and he was good at it. He could keep his secrets. That was all that mattered. Clothed in his flesh, I felt strong and vital. I felt the weight of his leather storm coat hanging from his shoulders. I felt the solidity of the matte black backhouse las pistol in his right hand. I felt the beat of his heart as if it were my own. "What is it?" I asked, gesturing with Methuen's hand at the cube.
"Unless I'm mistaken, which I'm not, it's a Gullivat riddle box. Rare. Priceless, actually. It explains a lot."
"I'm glad. Now you explain a lot." Thonius shrugged.
"It explains why we're here.
We were forced to mount this raid because I couldn't hook into Chaikov's data systems covertly from outside. Couldn't get a line, not even a whiff of data heat. This is why. She doesn't use a data system."
"Not at all."
"Do you see any cogitators, any codifiers, any data engines at all?"
He was right. The room was devoid of any computation devices. There wasn't even any electrical wiring, no ports, no vox links, nothing. Chaikov ran her entire operation on paper, the old-fashioned way. There was nothing that could be hacked or broken into.
"She's from Punzel. They pride themselves on mental rigor there, the old ways. Didn't you see the abacus frames the warehouse stackers were using as we came in?"
"I had. Plus, of course, the records suggest Chaikov was Cognite-trained. The Cognite use machines as little as possible, preferring to trust their own minds."
"Indeed."
"We could take her paper files if we had a bulk lifter and check through them, but I can tell you now they'd only be legit accounts and manifests. Her secrets are in here, stored in a non-electronic format."
I raised Zeph's pistol and headshot a moody hammer who had run into the chamber behind Carl. Carl flinched.
"Thrown. Some warning, if you don't mind."
"You mean like, look out, Carl, there's a man behind you with a gun. Oops, too late, he's shot you. That kind of thing."
"Smart ass. You know about riddle boxes, don't you?"
"Not really." He stroked the edges of the glass tube gently.
"They were made by the Gullivat 3,000 years ago, before they suffered their cultural backslide. The Gullivat are now a proto-primitive race, unable to fathom the mechanisms they created. They adored secrets and puzzles. Indeed, to this day, no one knows why their culture collapsed in the first place. The riddle boxes are artifacts. They come up for sale once in a while. I doubt Chaikov was rich enough to buy one. The cartel must have given her this to run their dealings."
"How does it work?"
"It's inert. A crystal cube within a crystal cube within a crystal cube, etc. There's no way of knowing how many layers it has. Usually they are built with anything from 10 to 17 layers. You see the figures carved into the sides?"
"Yes."
"The riddle box must be turned, each layer in sequence, carefully rotated until a final alignment is made. Then it opens. Inside there will be a codex stone, the size of a small pebble, a perfect glass sphere onto which all Chaikov's secrets are etched in microscopic form."
I glanced around. Outside, in a nearby hall, I could hear Nail and Kiss engaging fiercely with the last of Chaikov's household guards.
"Are you sure?" I asked.
"It could be just a curio, an ornament."
Carl shook his head. He pointed to a side table on which sat a complex instrument that looked like a microscope to me.
"There's the reader. You place the sphere in here and study it via the scope. And look. Here's the etching needle mount that swings in when she wants to add new information."
"So we just break it open?"
I suggested. It's constructed to grind the sphere clean if the cubes are tampered with.
I see. So why didn't Mlle. Tchaikov take this vital piece of data storage with her?
Because they're not called riddle boxes for no reason, Carl said. Unless you know the key, they're utterly impossible to open.
I was about to retort, but a lasround ripped across the chamber between us and hit the far wall, bringing down a silk hanging. Two house guards, both hammers of the K. Bright clan, had burst in through the west door, weapons up. I started to turn, but Carl had already swung round, bringing up the Hecate Six Will Tallowhand had given him years before. The Six barked loudly, its fat nose round, slamming both hammers back off their feet in showers of gore. Empty casings tinkled onto the marble floor. Carl walked over to the twitching bodies and put a round through each one's forehead. Carl Thonius was famously unhappy around guns. In fact, he was all but allergic to combat and physical confrontation. He was a thinker, a near-genius thinker, not a doer, and that was partly what endeared him to me and made me choose him as my interrogator. Let Nail and the others handle the bloodshed. Carl's worth was his mind and all the skills that lay within it. Indeed, he'd never fired his weapon in anger before that awful night on Flint a year ago, and then only in desperation. Now he used it with the nerve and confidence of a seasoned gunslinger. I was impressed, and not a little unnerved. "You've been practicing," I said.
"Oh, you know," he replied, bashfully holstering the piece. "The cosmos moves on and all that. Besides, I was tired of you taking the piss all the time."
"Me?"
"No, Mathewin."
"This box, Carl. Who has the key?" He smiled.
"My guess, Tchaikov. And Tchaikov alone."
"Kara, whatever you do, don't kill Tchaikov."
"Not actually a problem,"
Kara Swall replied, diving sideways in order to keep her head attached to her shoulders. Tchaikov's vampiric blade raked sparks from the metal deck.
"Any chance you could give this bitch the same advice vis-a-vis me?"
"She's wearing some sort of damper. I can't get in. Sorry."
"I had to ask."
Kara leapt up and around, and cycled with the shivered sword. But Tchaikov was there to deflect the strike, a ringing chime, and then plow under with a gut stab. The very tip of the power blade managed to slice into Kara's midriff armor and draw blood before she managed to cartwheel clear. Tasting blood, the vampire sword began to scream.
"Soon,"
Tchaikov said, patting the sweating blade. Kara landed stuck, feet wide, shivered sword horizontal at forehead height, left arm extended. Tchaikov turned her back and then came in again, sweeping up and low as she twisted. The blades met, once, twice, three times, four times, parry and redirect.
"It's tasted you now," Tchaikov spat. "This is over."
Kara blocked two more strokes, then staggered back, gasping. She clutched her belly and stared in disbelief. Blood was leaving her body. It was leaving her body through the cut, tumbling in droplets through the air. The slow arc of red drizzle pulled towards Tchaikov's blade. Kara fell on her knees. Her blood was flying out of her now, like red streamers, flowing towards the thirsty sword, collecting like dew on the blade. It was sucking her dry.
"Thrawn,"
Kara gasped.
"Help me."
Patience Kiss landed on the loading deck with a thump. Her kine blades orbited about her body like pilot fish around a shark. She blinked, and they flew forward at Tchaikov, and then clattered to the deck, dead, a few meters from her. Tchaikov's damper had cancelled out Kiss's telekinesis.
"Oh, gods!"
Kara cried, falling onto her side, trying to stop the blood from leaving her body with her hands. Patience ran forward a few steps, but Tchaikov turned and aimed the point of the blade at her.
"You'll be next, witch," she warned.
"No, I'll be next,"
said Harlan Nail. He staggered onto the dock through one of the inner gates, his bloody left arm limp at his side. His right hand raised and aimed his transvasor heavy. Tchaikov turned to face him, Kara's lifeblood drooling off her blade. Nail fired. Tchaikov swung the sword and deflected the shot, so it ricocheted away across the warehouse and buried itself in a bale of fabric. Nail fired again, and again Tchaikov knocked the round aside in midair with her sword. Nail nodded, impressed.
"A guy like me could grow to love a woman who can do that," he said.
Tchaikov bowed slightly in acknowledgement and then readdressed.
her sword upright in both hands, angled over her right shoulder. Nail raised his handgun again and slid his thumb across the selector lever.
"How do you do on full auto?"
he asked. The gun began to fire, roaring, one squeeze of the trigger unloading the full clip at automax. To her credit, Chaikov parried the first three shots. The fourth hit her in the left thigh, the fifth took off her right leg at the knee. She fell, and the rest went wide. The sword clattered to the deck, and then began to inch itself towards the pool of hot blood spreading from Chaikov's severed leg. It rattled itself into the pool and began to drink. Chaikov moaned, twitching. Nail holstered his weapon and walked over to her. He squeezed his gunshot left arm with his right hand and spattered blood onto the ground. The sword writhed and turned, scenting a fresh victim. It slithered towards Nail. He squeezed his wound harder, and more blood spurted out. This was too much for the sword. It flew at him. He sidestepped, and caught it by the hilt as it flew by. As soon as it was in his hand, he wrenched round violently and swung it down into the deck. It took three savage blows before the blade finally shattered. By then, the deck was deeply gouged. The blade wailed as it died. Nail threw the broken hilt away. He walked over to Chaikov.
"The key, please," he said.
"Never," she hissed.
"You're bleeding out fast, mademoiselle,"
he noted.
"Then I will die," she replied,
her rapid breath wafting her Molidiscu mask.
"Doesn't have to be that way,"
Nail said.
"What? Are you proposing to save me? Spare me? Get me to the medicaids?"
Nail shook his head. He reloaded his handgun and aimed it at her right temple.
"My offer is to make it quick. One brief instant of pain compared to a slow, lingering death."
Chaikov gasped.
"You are a man of honor, sir. I thank you. The key is 52865.
"And thank you,"
Nail said. He rose and began to walk away.
"I gave you the key,"
Chaikov cried.
"Now, do as you promised. Finish me."
Nail continued to walk.
"All right, all right,"
Chaikov called.
58265. That's the key. The real key. I lied before, but that's the real truth. Now kill me. End this pain. Please."
Nail kept walking.
"Still gonna check," he said.
Chapter 8. Winston Frauke heard the low warble of the detector alarm. He shot a look at Zale and put a finger to his lips. Then he got up, took a chromed auto snub from his jacket pocket, and went over to the portable Vox. He pushed the set's active key.
"Yes?" "It's us. Screen down, pop the locks, and let us in."
Frauke turned to the portable console nearby, which controlled the security screens Harlan had set up around Miserema's house, and deactivated them. He also turned the auto locks.
"Clear," he said into the Vox.
A minute or two later, the five figures came tramping up the stairs. Zeph Mathewin led the way, followed by Thonius, who was carrying some kind of glass box.
"How'd it go?" Frauke asked Mathewin, knowing full well that it wouldn't be Mathewin who replied.
Ravener's dormant chair sat in the corner of the room where Frauke had been keeping company through the evening with Zale.
"Badly," said Ravener in Mathewin's voice. "We got what we needed, but it turned into a bloodbath."
Zale had got to his feet and was now staring wide-eyed at the returners. Nail had a messy wound in the arm, and he was half-carrying Kara, who looked pale and ill.
"This is beyond our basic medical ability," said Ravener. "We're going to need a physician, someone who won't ask questions."
"I'll go find one," said Kiss, grimly.
"I know where to find one," said Zale. They all looked at him. "I come from here, remember? I know a guy."
"Very well," said Kiss to the boy. "You're with me."
They hurried out. Nail took Kara to one of the bedrooms and made her comfortable.
"Carl, get to work deciphering the contents of the box," Ravener said. "Oh, and check on Sko, too, please."
Thonius nodded and hurried away with his prize. Ravener sat Mathwin's body down in a battered armchair.
"Not a good night, then," Frauke said. "Chaikov's security was on a hair trigger. The moment they thought something was wrong, they just went off. It was bloody. We ended up torching the place to cover our tracks."
"You burned it down?" Frauke asked laconically, lighting a low stick. "There were a lot of bodies," Ravener said. "The longer it takes anyone to figure out what happened, the better. Chaikov was a powerful underworld figure. From the mess we left, people will suspect she ran foul of a rival operation." Matho inside. Ravener had just released him. He blinked and looked up at Frauke.
"Hey, whist,"
he said. He got to his feet.
"I'm hungry,"
he muttered, and left the room. The support chair hummed and swung around, prowling across the room towards Frauke. "So Nail took a bullet?" Frauke said. "What happened to the redhead?"
"Some kind of warped blade."
"All in a night's work?"
"I suppose so. I'm going to check on her. Then I'd better help Thonius unravel the data."
Before you go," Frauke began.
"Yes, Whiston."
"While you were all gone, the boy seemed to get a bit edgy. So I stayed with him, just chatting, you know.
Improving your people skills."
"Whatever." Frauke took a drag on his low stick. He seemed uncomfortable, as if not sure how to say something. "We talked about this and that, his past, growing up here. I think coming back to Eustace Majoris has woken up some memories. He was telling me about his granna and his sister."
"Well, I'm glad he was able to confide in you."
Frauke held up a hand and waved it gently. "No, it's not that. Do you know what his name is?"
"Of course," Ravener replied. "It's Zael Eternity. One of the first things he told me."
"Yeah," said Frauke. "Eternity. His father's family name. But in our little chat tonight, it just slipped out that Zael's ma and pa never actually applied for a marriage license from the state."
"So? He was born out of wedlock. So what?"
"Well, just as a technicality, that would mean his surname should actually be his mother's family name, not his father's.
The one he adopted.
Right?"
"Right. But it is just a technicality. Why do you think that's important?"
"Because it turns out his mother's family name," said Whiston Frauke, "was Sleet." Thonius unlocked the door and looked in. Sko sat on the chair. The hunter slowly turned his head and looked at Karl.
"Food?"
he asked. "We're a little busy. We'll get to it." Sko raised his manacled hands slightly.
"Getting cramp in my wrists again. Bad cramp."
"All right," said Karl with a sigh. He walked into the room until he was just beyond the reach of the floor chain. "Show me." Sko raised his hands to show that both of the heavy steel manacles were locked tight around his wrists. Karl nodded, took the key from his pocket, and tossed it to Sko. The hunter caught it neatly, unlocked his manacles, and growled with relief. He nursed and rubbed his wrists, flexing them and stretching them out.
"Hell, that's better."
"That's enough," said Karl. Sko finished his stretching and locked the manacles in place again. He tossed the key back to Karl. "Show me." Sko repeated his gesture, raising his hands so that Karl could clearly see the manacles were tight and secure. Karl walked out of the room and locked the door behind him. His right hand was shaking again. The raid at Chaikov's had been a real adrenaline rush, a real ride. He'd done well. He'd got what Ravener needed. But Sko had brought him down hard. Something about the hunter freaked Thonius out, even when he was locked up. Karl had a sour taste in his mouth, and his heart was knocking. He knew he had to get back downstairs and start work on the riddle box. But he wanted to smooth his wits out first. He went into the bathroom, pulled the bolt on the door, and took the parcel of red tissue paper out of his pocket. They rode one of the sink-level trains across the eastern quadrant of the city and climbed off in a filthy substation that the sign said was Informal J.
"This is where you grew up," Patience said.
Zael nodded.
"I'm sure I could have found a doctor closer to the house."
"We need the right sort of doctor,"
Zael said.
"The right sort, yeah? I mean one who won't ask questions or anything."
Patience couldn't argue with that.
"Well, there was a guy in my Hab neighborhood. We called him the Locum. I think he's what you want."
Hot, dirty winds scorched up the transit tunnels as other clattering trains approached. Zael led Patience up the iron stairs into the dark, dripping sinks of Formal J. It was not a good part of town. So much trash and acid wash had accumulated in the lower sinks. Most foot traffic came and went on the higher walkways between the crumbling habstacks. They passed a few rowdy bars and dining houses, bright with lights and drunken noise. But for the most part it was a slum city, full of poverty-trapped souls who lingered in the doorways of their ratty habs, or sat on the front steps of stacks, passing around bottles without labels. The street air reeked of acid and urine. It reminded patients a little of Urbitane, the hive stack on Sameter, where she'd grown up. But there had been a spark of urgency there, a sense of life fighting to catch a break amid the squalor. Here, it felt like people had just given up all hope. They walked for 20 more minutes into a network of dark lanes and channels between condemned habs. A train rattled past on an elevated rail. "Here," said Zale, leading her into the ground floor of some kind of community building that had been grossly vandalized. The feral slogans of moody clans were painted on the walls.
"Here?" she queried.
"You saw the sign, right? It said, surgery."
"Uh-huh, but it appeared to have been handwritten in blood."
They entered a broken-down room where a few people sat around on mismatched chairs. An old man, a far gone, an emaciated addict with the shakes, a worried-looking hab-wife with a small child, a young drunk with a nasty cut across his brow. "If this is triage," thought Kiss, "I can't wait to see the Medicaid. Some rancid old quack or backstreet abortionist." Zale led her through an inner door. The locum was busy. A moody hammer was sitting in an old barber's chair, and, by the light of a makeshift lamp, the locum was stitching up the 20-centimeter gash across his shoulder. A blade wound, Kiss was quite sure. The room itself was surprisingly tidy, though nothing in it was new. There were a few pieces of medical equipment, tools thrust into a jar of anti-backed gel in a vague nod to sterility. The locum had his back to them as he worked. He was of medium build, slim and wiry. His hair was light brown, and he was wearing heavy lace-up boots, black combat baggies, a black vest, and surgical gloves. "Get in line," he called. "I'll get to everyone in turn."
"Hey," said Zale.
"Didn't you hear me?" the locum said and turned. Kiss saw his face, strong, calm, rather lined and care-drawn. His eyes were blue and fiercely intelligent. Right now they were a little puzzled.
"Zale," he said.
"Zale Eternity, that you, Ked?"
"Hey, Dr. Belknap." "Throne, Zale, I haven't seen you for a year or more. Someone said you were dead."
"Not me." Zale shook his head.
"Good, that's good.
Who's this?" Belknap asked, looking over at Kiss.
"She's..."
"A friend of Zale's," said Patience. "I need a Medicaid. He recommended you."
"Yeah? What's wrong with you?"
"Nothing. But I need a Medicaid to come with me and treat two other friends of Zale's."
"You need a Medicaid," said Belknap. "Go to the local infirmary. Public ward."
"I need a certain type of Medicaid," Patience said smoothly.
"Yeah? What type is that?"
"The type who sews up a Moody Hammer's gang fight wounds, no questions asked."
Belknap looked back at Zale.
"Damn it, boy, what have you gotten yourself mixed up in?"
"Nothing bad, I swear," Zale said. The locum turned back to his work.
"Will you come?" Patience asked.
"Yes, for Zale's sake. When I'm finished here." They waited an hour while he treated the people in line. Then Belknap put on an old ex-military storm coat, picked up a black leather practice bag, and followed them out onto the sink street.
"You're not going to lock up?" Kiss asked him.
"Nothing worth stealing," said Belknap. "And round here, if you lock a door, folk will kick it in just to know why." They caught a sub-train and rattled back across the quarter through the dark, labyrinthine foundations of the hive. Just the three of them, alone in a vandalized carriage. Kiss noticed the old dog tags on a chain around Belknap's neck. He didn't seem more than 30, 35, although prematurely aged.
"Guard vet?" she asked.
"Company field medic. 6 years. I mustered out when the chance came along."
"Why?"
"Couldn't stand the sight of blood." She smiled.
"And really?"
He looked up at her. His eyes, always half closed, as if squinting at something bright. They were really something. "I don't even know your name," he said. "I'm not about to tell you my personal business."
"Okay. But between guard service and sewing up stab victims in a sink-level ruin, what?
9 years as a community medicae. I had a practice in the 4th Ward of Formal J. The carriage rocked violently as the train rode over points in the dark. Kiss, who was standing, steadied herself against the handrail.
"Why do you stop?" she asked.
"I didn't. I still serve the 4th Ward, in Formal J."
"Yeah, but not officially. You're a backstreet guy."
"That's me. A real vigilante."
"So? Why?"
The overheads flickered on and off for a second as the jolting disrupted the live rail. The carriage flashed into strobing blue darkness. Then bare white light again. "You ask a lot of questions," said Belknap.
"I'm inquisitive," Kiss said. "Professionally."
"Leave him alone. Stop asking him stuff,"
Zale sent. Kiss still wasn't happy about him being able to do that. And when he did it, it hurt a little. He hadn't refined his talent.
"I'll ask him what I like, Zale," she nudged back. "We're going to trust him with Kara and Nail. I want to know what we can."
Belknap looked back and forth between them, smiling slightly. "What was that?" he asked, pointing a finger at her, then him. "You two got a private code or something?"
"Or something," said Zale.
"What is it?" "A gang code. Number of blinks. Secret signals." Belknap shook his head sadly. "Yeah, all the money, it's a gang code. She's definitely connected, that one."
"Like you wouldn't believe," said Kiss.
"And you," Belknap said, looking at Zale. "I always hoped you'd escape, you know. Not slide in like all the others. I always said that, didn't I?"
"You did," admitted Zale.
"I know the odds were stacked against you, especially in a dirt box like the J, but I hoped. You have a good brain on you, Zale Affinity. If you'd stuck to Skolam, trained maybe, got a decent trade, you could have contributed, made a life for yourself, against all those odds. But I guess the easy option was always going to suck you in." Kiss, suddenly, oddly, felt rather protective. Zale looked like he was going to cry.
"Zale didn't take any easy option, Doctor," she said quietly.
"Yeah, that's the real truth, isn't it?" the Medicaid said. "The life you people choose, it looks easy. A few risks, a fast fortune. But it's never easy in the end." Kiss caught Zale's eye, and they both started laughing. "I say something funny?" Belknap asked.
"Hysterical," said Kiss. "Now tell me, why did you quit the community practice?"
Belknap's compelling blue eyes stared straight up at her.
"I didn't.
You want to know? Okay. I was disbarred. The Departmental Medicaid struck me off and stripped me of my practice. They took away my credentials because I was found guilty of serious malpractice. Okay?"
"Thrown, Zale. You brought me to him? We need a Medicaid, not an incompetent."
"Ask him why."
"What?"
"Ask the doc why he was struck off."
"Why?" asked Kiss.
"I said, malpractice. Serious professional misconduct, contrary to my oath as a Medicaid Imperialis." Kiss shook her head, reached into her pocket, and threw a handful of change at Belknap.
"Next stop, get off. Find your own way back. I'm sorry to have inconvenienced you. We'll find someone else. Someone competent."
Zale got up.
"Tell her," he cried. "Tell her the reason, Doc."
Belknap glanced at him.
"It doesn't matter, Zale. Tell her. That's my business."
Zale turned to Kiss.
"They disbarred him for fraud. It was a cash thing. He was only trying to... For Throne's sake, Doc, explain it to her. I don't know how to describe it."
Belknap breathed in deeply. "My community practice had a budget. There was nothing like enough. You've seen the way it is down in the J. I could barely cope. Malnutrition, low-grade pollution disorders, addiction, chronic disease. People were dying. Really, actually dying, I mean, because I couldn't afford the treatments for everyone. So I tried to work the system. I filed false subsist vouchers, claimed for practice expenses that didn't exist, defrauded the welfare system, just so I could bulk up my budget and afford the things I needed. The things my patients needed. The administratum caught me fair and square, tore up my license, kicked me out, and told me I was lucky not to get a custodial.
See?
Said Zale to Kiss. So you just practiced now anyway? Kiss asked. As a rogue medic, eh?
Listen, Mamselle, friend of Zale's. The formal infirmaries automatically deny treatment to any clan members injured in street clashes, any drug addicts, any persons who've lost their subsist code, any child who doesn't present with a registered parent or guardian. The Administratum, by its own figures, recommends there should be one practicing medic for every 5,000 citizens of any imperial city. You know what the split is here in Petropolis? One medic for every 100,000 habbers. 100,000, so help me. You think the God Emperor of Mankind is happy that's the way it is here? I'm just trying to even down the stats.
The train rocked. The lights went on and off again, quickly. The train was pulling into a sub-stop. Belknap collected up the scattered change. Good luck, he said. Zale. It might be way too late, but be a good boy, all right? The train shuddered to a halt. The auto hatches opened. Belknap got up, but Patience was right in front of him.
My name's Patience Kiss, she said.
Patrick Belknap, he replied.
Isn't that Medicaid, Patrick Belknap? She asked.
They looked at each other for a long moment.
Sit down, sir, she said. You'll do.
He sat.
Patience Kiss, eh?
I look forward to finding out your real name.
Don't hold your breath, she replied.
The hatches slipped closed, and the train began to pull away. Chapter 9 Across the hive, out where formal queue met the bay, the occulting lighthouse was blinking into the night. It was one of the 29 station lighthouses that warded the curved seaboard of Petropolis. The private flyer swung down out of the sky through the squalling rain. It landed on its 8 jointed legs in the center of the stone dock, and then, wings cased, walked itself over until its body hatch was under the rain guard awning. The entrance was lit with fluttering candles and glow globes. Magus Clancula Lezard and about 40 of the Frattery's seers stood in the wind, waiting. The body hatch opened, 3 figures dismounted and strode, side by side, towards the doorway. Orpheo Kulzean, businesslike in a blue suit, flanked to his right by Layla Slade, dressed in dark red. Her right hand was poised on the butt of the handgun, holstered in the small of her back, and she scanned left and right, watching for movements out amongst the dark and the rain-blurred lights of the vehicle. At Kulzean's left walked Saul Keener, the notorious unsanctioned psyker. He had prospered over the years by offering his skills via Petropolis's black market, and he was always in demand. He was a short dumpling of a man. His fine clothes spoke of his wealth, and his build positively screamed of the obscene high living his art had afforded him. Keener displayed the symptoms of an obsessive compulsive. He was constantly rubbing his beringed sausage fingers together, and he had a great many ticks and quivers that flapped his round, jowly face. Keener held the trigger orb in his fat hands. He'd had it close to him for several hours, so as to build a simpatico with the incunabula.
"We look upon you, Orpheo,"
Magus Clancula Lezard said.
"Magus Clancula, thank you for this greeting. Thank you to the Frattery for making us welcome here."
Kulzean's molten voice somehow cut through the sound of the rain and the flyer's panting jet pods.
"Enter,"
Lezard said. He turned, his exoskeleton hissing in step with Kulzean. Slade and the Psyker came behind, trailed by the body of the freighters.
"Everything's prepared?"
Kulzean asked, as they walked down the entrance hall of the old lighthouse.
"Everything to your requirements. It's all prepared."
"The device I sent you. It's safe."
"Perfectly safe, Orpheo."
They came out into the basement chamber of the lighthouse, a drum of a room, formed from local stock brick and dripping from the sea. The correct number of tapers, 3,109, were lit about the place. The device sat in the center of the floor, silent, surrounded by the scribings. The marks on the stone floor formed a perfect pentagramic ward. They had been made with bone ash, or at least Kulzean hoped so, or the night would come to a very sudden, very messy end. Inside the outer scribings, the cages of payment
waited. The poor human vermin within the iron boxes mewled and scratched.
"Locals?" asked Kalzian.
"Mostly," said Lazard. "But some of the freighters, too. Those who have suffered the unholy macula and who are of no use to us as seers."
"Anything you need to update me on? Anything new? New determiners? Has the Frateries meniscus revealed any changes?"
"Some,"
Lazard gurgled. He nodded to Stefoy, and the seer handed Kalzian a clump of papers on which recent seeings had been scribbled.
"No, not important, no,"
Kalzian said, sorting through them and crumpling some to throw aside.
"This, interesting, a change in the clouding here, just an hour or two ago. Suddenly the prospect is more likely. Why?"
"We have not yet fathomed it," replied Arthus. "But we are pleased."
"Curious."
Kalzian continued to stare at the scrap of paper.
"There is a name here. What is it?"
Layla Slade leaned over and looked. "Belknap, sir," she said.
"Belknap. Fascinating."
Orfeo Kalzian threw the crumpled paper away and looked at the next.
"Now, this,"
he began.
"We were pleased by that reading,"
Lazard said.
"It supports your instinct. That man, high-born and powerful though he might be, is the key at this time. The most potent determiner. If he continues in his path, the prospect will fail."
"So nice to be vindicated," Kalzian grinned. "Saul, would you like to take your place and we can get started? I sense a scratchy impatience within the device. Magus Clancula, withdraw your freighters."
Lazard turned and ushered his followers back, until they were lost in the darkness of the basement, behind the candles. Kalzian could see their augmetic eyes glowing in the gloom like a gang of cyclopses.
"Layla,"
Kalzian said over his shoulder,
"be ready. Shoot anything that doesn't obey."
The woman nodded and drew out her Hostek livery 50. She slid out the clip of standard rounds and slotted in a magazine of specially prepared loads. Then she slunk the slide.
"Master Keener,"
Kalzian said,
"go to work."
Saul Keener raised the trigger orb and, as he had been instructed, started to slide reality with his mind. It grew cold in the basement of the occulting lighthouse. The device in the center of the floor began to vibrate. It was a small pyramid, wrought in gold and silver. It started to rock and vibrate, as if a charge were passing through it. Keener pressed on, turning the orb in his hands. The device continued to quiver.
"I sense him now," Keener muttered. "Oh, yes, he's coming to my bidding. Oh, yes, here."
The 3,109 candle flames flared and grew taller. The light spread. The little golden pyramid shook again, and then unfolded. It didn't unleash a figure. It bent and deformed to create one. The folding golden sides twisted and extended, clothing a shape that coalesced out of a mist that spilled from the opening center of the pyramid. A crouched, hunched figure formed, head down, curled. The golden tracery of the device wrapped itself up and down the figure's limbs, creating armor, an encasing suit, a crested helmet. The brass thief rose to its feet. Smoke poured off it, gusted from its awakening. It was thin, wrapped in segmented plates of gold and brass, faceless but for eyelets in the high-crested helm.
"The Incunabula is awake,"
Keener whispered.
"Tell it to feast,"
Kalzian said. Keener spoke with his mind, via the orb, and the golden figure stepped forward. Warp smoke dribbled off its golden limbs. It raised its hands and, with a wet click, extended the rhyming swords. It took a step towards the nearest cage. The sacrifices within saw it coming and squealed. It lashed through the bars, its blades meeting flesh, and began to feed. 6 minutes later, with the cages reduced to buckled frames full of fuming bones, the Incunabula clacked the edge of the scribing and folded its rhyming swords.
"It's ready,"
Keener said, rubbing frantically at his hands.
"It's really ready. It's fed, and it's yearning to know what is next. It wants to know why you've woken it."
Kalzian nodded. He looked round at Layla Slade, who had been training her handgun on the Incunabula for the last 5 minutes.
Put that away, Lay,
Kalzian said. He took a step forward until just the outer line of scribing separated him from the incunabula.
Hello,
Kalzian said softly.
Remember me? Of course you do. I'm going to show you a name. You know what to do then.
Kalzian held up one of the scraps of paper.
You see? Read it right. Understand.
The brass thief gently nodded its crested helm.
That name is Yeda Trice, said Kalzian. Do your worst.
The brass thief rocked, and vast metal wings articulated out of its back. The wings flapped, and it ascended, turning out of the scribed circle, out of the lighthouse, towards the city. Chapter 10. The speech, which had been elegantly crafted and masterfully delivered, came to an end, and the audience rose to its feet, applauding wildly. The furious approval shook the majestic state banqueting hall, the most regal chamber of the diplomatic palace in formal A. At the head of the fan-crowded tables, the speaker waved his hand and accepted the applause graciously, smiling at the cheers he had raised from the assembled high-born dignitaries of the Manufacturing Guild. The Guild was one of the most influential bodies in the subsector, representing both state and private business interests, and its leaders were men and women of great learning, wit, and commercial acumen. And also fools, thought Yeda Trice, if they could be brought to their feet in jubilation by meaningless phrases such as genuine market prosperity, financial upturn, and glorious futures for our children's generation, all strung together and said out loud. Of course, it was the way he had said them. The guild mistress, Sephon Halwa, got up from her seat behind Trice, shook his hand, and gestured broadly to calm the assembly. The uproar slowly died away. Halwa was a tall, poised woman in her 170s, who looked a youthful 40-something, thanks to the expensive juvenile treatments she had enjoyed. Her hair, the colour of spun gold, was contained in a crispinette of white ribbon behind her round ermine hat and barbette, and her long gown, covered by the ornately embroidered mantle of her office, was made of ice-white silk and frieze. She raised her goblet. Her gown had long ballooning sleeves tied with golden thread around her cuffs. Wise, thought Trice, to choose a cut that conceals your elbows, my mistress. It was always the elbows that gave away a woman's true age, no matter how strenuous the juvenile work.
My guild fellows, she said, I would ask you to join me as I pledge a heartfelt thanks to the honoured speaker at our annual dinner, the first provost of the Ministry of Subsector Trade, Sire Yeda Trice.
More applause, and a general loud toasting as the cups were raised. Almost at once, music struck up from the gallery, and attendants hurried forward to clear the tables. Some guests resumed their seats, others moved forward into the open floor space to begin the stately dances.
Fine words, Provost,
the guild mistress said as she sat down next to Trice.
You know how to stir an assembly.
If only you knew, Trice murmured.
I'm sorry,
she said, leaning forward.
The music is rather loud.
I said I am gratified, mistress. Halwa turned to speak with a guild senior who had approached. Trice sat for a moment, toying with his goblet, staring at the dancers, the hurrying servants, the clusters of guests in loose conversation. Yeda Trice was a slender, ageless man with a distinguished beard on his chin and long, black hair that he had tied back for the evening. He had unmatched eyes, one sea-blue, the other ember-brown. He wore heavy brocade robes of gold and sari over a long gown of silver willow thread. His amulet of office hung around his neck on weighty gold links. Sharp-minded, silk-tongued, he was one of the most effective and assured political operators in the Angelus sub. Trice recognized no superior except the Lord Governor Subsector himself, and the ministry he controlled had been established by Barazan when he had come to office in 400. Trice was a little weary. The day had been long and spoiled by an unexpected turn of events. He also had little relish of functions such as the guild banquet, but these were important people, and he wanted to keep them on his side.
My lord.
Trice looked up. Right across the busy hall, 200 meters away, a figure had appeared, and was standing in the grand doorway, half hidden by the ormolu frame.
I need a word.
Trice nodded slightly, so only the figure would notice. He rose to his feet.
Not going, surely. You promised me a spin, Halwa said, turning to look at him.
Several guildsmen around them also urged him to stay. Trice smiled his most winning smile. Of course not, my friends, but you know my job never stops. Word is the value of the crown, which we all worship as the true master of mankind, do we not? The guilders roared at his joke. The value of the crown in the Rimwood market is still declining. I have to put in a call to the chief treasurer on Caxton before the market closes. Once that onerous duty is done, the chief treasurer does so enjoy the sound of his own voice, amplified by Astropath. More laughter. I will return. Between you and me, honored friends, it's jitters. Our Lord Bazaran came to office 3 years ago, and the honeymoon period is over. Investors and some trade amalgams in the Rim are getting edgy that the liberal reforms our Lord promised at inauguration are slow to be fulfilled. What is it I always say?
These things take time, a senior guilder nearby called.
Precisely, Sire Onrus. Trice smiled as the laughter buffeted once again. So excuse me while I take a moment to dampen their nerves. You'll appreciate it on the morrow when you slate read your trading portfolios. As for you, dear Mistress Halwa, I swear on my mother's pristine honor that I will return in no more than 15 minutes. Then you will experience a volta more sublime than your wildest dreams. Yet more laughter, led by the exaggeratedly demure Halwa. Trice strode from the table. Immediately, 4 waiting house guards from the gubernatorial service closed around him. Bullish men in dark blue leather and ceramite, visors down, hell guns mag clamped to their chest plates. As a senior official of the subsector administratum, Trice enjoyed all the protection benefits of the Lord Governor himself. Escorted, he walked down the length of the banquet hall and out into the crystal-lit grand processional. The chatter and music of the feast dimmed behind him. The figure was waiting for him up ahead, beside the door of a privacy suite. Servants dashed past. "Wait here," Trice ordered his houseguard squad, and went into the suite with the waiting figure. The suite was a series of luxurious meeting rooms, designed to be completely surveillance-opaque, so that the senior ambassadors of the diplomatic department could conduct conversations in the strictest secrecy. As soon as he was inside, the door closed. Trice felt the vibration hum of audio bouncers, vox inhibitors, and psi-blunt systems activating and overlapping. Trice walked over to a gilt cabinet and poured himself a large Amasek. "Anything for you, Tauros?" Tauros Revoke shook his head politely. Revoke was wearing a subtle, dark suit, and his hands were gloved. He was as much a part of Trice's protection as the armed house guards waiting outside. But nothing like so official. Tauros Revoke was a senior lieutenant of an unofficial body known as the Secretists.
"Well, that's another evening of my life I'm never getting back," Trice said, sipping his Amasek and sitting down on an upholstered tub chair.
He crossed his legs, folding the heavy gown across his knees for comfort. "They're all idiots," he realized. "Every last jack one of them. Fools in love with profit. I could have told them I shat stools of solid gold, and they'd have asked me to show them how."
"The public face,"
Revoke said. Trice nodded.
"The public face. So tell me about your day. Tell me something to make me happy."
"Well?" "You've got bad news, haven't you, Tauros?"
"Not at all. Curious news, perhaps. I'll start with the good. 9 more private masses went ahead tonight, all as decreed, all in temples along the defined axes."
"I heard there was trouble the other night. Where was it?"
"The chapel at Rudiment and Pass on Over. The usual story. A poor nobody who shouldn't have been there wandered in on the service."
"Did he see anything?" Trice asked, swirling the dark liquor in his glass.
"Oh, plenty. Fortunately, I was there to secret the mass. I brought along Monica and Drax, too."
"How is Monica?"
"Still not sure who she is. She's a dissembler. It goes with the territory. We turfed the man out and saw to him."
"Cleanly?"
"The unkindness stripped him bare."
Trice smiled.
"I do so love it when this city looks after its own secrets."
Revoke crossed the room and sat down in a plush seat opposite Trice.
"I understand today has been eventful. I heard about the business at the sacristy. Do you need my people to cover that?"
Trice shook his head.
"No, it's in hand.
Could be a blessing, actually. It may transpire that we've been mislocating the true center all this time."
There is a secrecy issue. Some strand of the magistratum has got to it already. But I've put wheels in motion. So now, this curious news of yours.
Akunin wants an audience with you. Pretty much demands it.
Trice lit a low stick from the casket on the table beside his chair. Shipmaster Akunin knows it doesn't work that way. No direct contact between me and the contractees.
Even so,
screw him. What does he want to see me about? Revoke leaned forward.
Earlier tonight, a premises run by the cartel's chosen banker was raided. Burned down. A lot of deaths.
Then the cartel's a fool for using a financier who ran so close to the wind. Chaikov was black market. She had any number of enemies. It's not our concern where they stash the money we pay them. Die, too, did she? Revoke nodded.
It appears so. I have my team sifting the wreckage right now. A gang dispute, I think. One of her rivals in the underworld.
So, why is Akunin asking for me?
He thinks it's more than that. He believes it could be the work of someone who is trying to break our program open.
Trice frowned. He set his glass down and took a long draw from the smouldering low stick. Is that possible?
I don't believe so, Revoke replied. There was one potential troublemaker, but you sent him to his doom yourself.
I did. Tell Akunin to get over it and use a more reliable money launderer. But keep an eye on what you turn up. I don't want us to be caught out. Was that all? Revoke rose.
Yes, Lord. Thank you.
Trice stubbed out his stick. Thank you. Back to the party, I suppose. Revoke held the door open for his master, and Trice stepped out of the suite. The waiting gubernatorial servicemen closed around the first provost to lead him back down the processional to the banquet hall. An 8-meter-square skylight above them exploded in a blizzard of glass debris. Looking up in the storm of falling shards, reaching for their weapons, the servicemen got one brief glimpse of the attacker. The paired rhyming swords took off two heads and ripped open the torsos of the other two. Yeda Trice turned as the brass thief landed behind him. Glass fragments were raining down from the window, and the ripped bodies of the four servicemen were still falling, blood sheeting from their awful wounds. Crested helm bowed, its arms like gold-sleeved pistons, the brass thief struck its rhyming swords at Yeda Trice. Trice gawped in dread as the razor-edged blade swung at him simultaneously. But he was a quick-witted man. He had already activated the displacer field built into his amulet of office. Yeda Trice vanished in an oily smudge of air and reappeared 10 meters away down the processional. The incunabula's blades sliced through empty space. It paused, lifting its golden-crested helm, reacquired its quarry, and bounded forward. Alarms were suddenly ringing. Half a dozen armed magistratum officers spilled out into the long hallway and found themselves between the chief provost and the golden demon. The incunabula didn't break stride. It had ploughed through them before they had even realized what was going on. Two more armored heads were carved in half. Then the demon speared its blades into two chests, somersaulted, and brought the rhyming swords down in scything strokes that cleft the last two from their shoulders to their navels. One of the final pair opened fire, but it was just a nerve spasm. Hellgun shots wickered up the processional wall as the man collapsed.
Avanti!
Trice yelled at the oncoming monster, his hands forming a hexagramic sign in its face. The incunabula recoiled for a moment, then spun its blades and pounced at the chief provost. Autofire of tremendous force blew it out of the air before it could reach him. It crashed sideways into the wall, crazed the stone facing, and hit the ground. Before it could rise, a second blaze of autofire smacked into it, tumbling it away across the marble floor. By now, the music in the hall had broken off, and hundreds of voices were rising in loud panic. Taurus Revoke strode towards the crumbled incunabula, keeping the hellgun he had snatched from one of the butchered house guards raised and aimed. It wasn't dead, he could see that. It had soaked up a lot of punishment, but still, it wasn't dead. Revoke started firing again, ripping the creature backwards. Then the power clip was out, the weapon dead, and the brass thief was surging up at him, renewed, blades whirring. The first chop sheared the hellgun in half. Revoke flicked aside like a dancer, turning a one-handed spring that took him clear.
The thief jerked its golden head round, cocked on one side, as if curious. It swung murderously for revoke again, and again he evaded, this time with a rapid backwards handspring. The brass thief made an odd, pulsing sound. It was laughing in delight to have found an opponent who could even begin to trouble it. It engaged revoke again. This time there was no holding back. The dark-suited man and the golden demon turned and spun and dodged and struck and ducked and blocked, inhuman blurs, faster than the eye could follow. Saul Keener shuddered slightly and groaned. The sound was disturbingly loud in the close silence of the lighthouse basement.
"What's the matter with him?" Leila Slade asked.
Orfeo Kulzean didn't reply. The lights of the freighter's intently staring eyes filled the darkness around them.
"Saul," Kulzean said softly, "let me look."
He reached out his own right hand and touched its fingertips to the trigger orb. He pursed his lips as he began to share the psycast images.
"I see the thief," he said. "I see the chief provost fleeing down a great hallway. But there's someone in the way, a man. He's preventing the thief from reaching Trice."
"How?"
Leila Slade asked.
"He,"
Kulzean began, uncertainly.
"He is fighting with it. He seems to be unarmed. But he has closed with it. Oh, so fast. He's matching it move for move, reading every cut it tries to make, evading. The speed, the skill is phenomenal."
"No one can do that," said Leila Slade. "Not against the Incunabula. It's not possible."
"It seems it is. I'm seeing it," said Kulzean. "I knew Trice would employ seriously capable protectors, but this is a revelation. The movements are so fluid, so fast, I can scarcely track them. But it won't last."
"You're sure?"
asked the Magus Clancula.
"The thief never tires. The man will. And he is, as I said, unarmed. All he can do is protect himself."
Instinct told Revoke he was just 2, maybe 3 strokes from running out of luck. He couldn't sustain this pace of combat much more than a few seconds longer. He sidestepped the thief and yelled an unword in desperation. The force of the unword smashed the Incunabula back 50 meters. It hit the processional sidewall, cratering it, and fell to the floor.
What was that?
Saul Keener gasped.
"I don't know,"
Kulzean snapped.
"Hold your concentration, dammit!"
Revoke sprinted down the hall and caught up with Trice. He started to hurry his master towards the nearest exit.
"Securitas!" he yelled into his vox. "Securitas to the main processional! Code black!" "What was it?"
Trice asked, his eyes wide with shock.
"Not was, is, still. Come on!"
Almost dragging Trice, Revoke reached the stairwell that led down to the palace's wide courtyard. Behind him, the Incunabula stirred and got up. It flew after its prey, down the hall, down the staircase, into the courtyard, and halted. The raised weapons of 60 palace troopers faced it. The men opened fire. The vast barrage blew the stone doorway apart, shattered the lintel, and punched deep shot craters in the stones of the wall. The night lit up with a dazzling storm of energy bolts. The Incunabula came out of that fire, lasrounds bouncing like raindrops off the primevally forged metal of its sheathing armor. The rhyming swords glowed red with heat as they swung. A guard lost his face in a burst of blood. Another went over headless. A third staggered back, missing his left arm. A fourth was savagely deprived of most of his rifle and both the hands that had been clutching it. Still, the shots rained as the brass thief hacked into their ranks. 2 men toppled slackly, their waists clean severed. A decapitation. A trooper fell to his knees, trying to hold his stomach in. Another fell on his back, his sternum snapped through. The troopers kept shooting, though they were now backing away, splashing through the pooling blood that was starting to cover the flagstones. An arm was struck off, a leg at the knee. A man flew backwards through the air, cut in 2, and crunched down on the roof of a parked transport, bursting out the windows. A trooper sank onto his side, clutching his visor. Another dragged himself across the slippery paving, trying to find his legs.